Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome back to Third Stream View here on BBSRadio.com, Station 2, every Monday evening, 8:55 Pacific, 10:55 Central, 11:55 Eastern. And I am your humble host, PK, a brilliant self-proclaimed intellectual, capable of speaking about economics, world history, world geography, geopolitics, the evils of Zionism, the problem with Israel, American foreign policy, libertarianism, philosophy. I'm a legend in my own mind. And before I continue with my wisdom, as I always do, I want to pay homage and praise and thank the suits at BBSRadio.com for promoting free speech, free thought, free markets. And I know I'm getting a call from somebody who shouldn't be calling me. So I'm on air right now, and I've received a call from my friend, but we're going to call him. So I got to finish my little monologue here. And soon we'll be talking to my friend in a few. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Hang on. I'll call you. Bye. Hang up. So anyway, ladies and gentlemen, before I was rudely interrupted by my guest, I want to thank the folks in the office at BBSRadio.com for promoting free speech, free press, First Amendment rights, and free minds and free thought. So thank you, gentlemen, for what you do for our First Amendment rights. And thank goodness for alternative media, because the general corporate Zionist media is very skewed about many things, especially the Middle East and Israel. And now we got Ahmadinejad was here last week. And I like what he had to say. I don't believe that Iran's trying to create a nuclear bomb, because next door in ever so saintly Israel, they've got 200 to 300 nukes. So Iran knows if they launched a nuke, they would be vaporized. So the thing is, if a country has a nuke, Uncle Sam tends not to mess with you. Israel also has nuclear submarines, which are very threatening, and they've got nuclear warheads on them, as if Israel needs submarines. But we'll get to the politics later today. I think my friend Blaine is with us now, and we're going to talk about music for a while. Blaine, are you out there, sir?
I'm here, PK. How you doing tonight?
I'm doing well. Thank you for coming back on to Third Stream View. Would you care for some tea or coffee?
No, thanks. I'm trying to cut back.
Good, because it is self-service.
Okay.
So,
all right.
Let's move right along. You're an experienced musician, having played with many different groups and such. And recently, you played with the legendary Quicksilver Messenger Service at the Monterey Pop Festival. Now, despite my wisdom, I'm familiar with the name, the band, Quicksilver Messenger Service, but through Bill Graham's Fillmore West, he would introduce them in Fillmore East. I really don't know their music, but I knew they were out in the late 60s, early 70s, the Grateful Dead sort of thing, I think, crowd.
Yeah, very, very, very similar in a lot of ways to the Grateful Dead. The trio, the Dead being the most famous, obviously, and then the Airplane next, but the trio of the Jefferson Airplane, Grateful Dead, and Quicksilver Messenger Service played so many gigs in that time period together, and with other groups as well. But Quicksilver was definitely a San Francisco-based band, and they lived in the city, and yeah, they played so many gigs. I mean, if you see any of those old posters, Quicksilver is all over the place.
Yeah, I've seen those. I was just curious. You mentioned the trio of bands. Is there any evidence that Grace Slick was shared by band members of all three bands?
Well, I hadn't heard that, but I had definitely heard that Grace was very loving and friendly with her band members.
Available,
and,
yes.
Yeah, and so, you know, that wouldn't be, I guess that wouldn't be far-fetched. That's quite possible that she was friendly with the Grateful Dead and Quicksilver and maybe many other bands. Hard to say, you know. Those were crazy.
True, a little humor there, thank you very much. And I want to share this quote with you before we go on, and I hope the Suits are listening. The music business is a cruel and shallow money trench, a long plastic hallway where thieves and pimps run free and good men die like dogs. There is also a negative side.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the music business, all right.
Do you know who wrote that?
Miles Davis, I'm guessing. I don't know.
Hunter S. Thompson.
Okay.
If you've seen Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas.
Uh-huh.
He was sort of a drunk leftover hippie, I think, and quite a good writer, actually. Unfortunately, he killed himself several years ago, but there you go.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I have to agree with what he says. What he said.
So,
yes.
How many rehearsals did you have with Quicksilver?
I had one. I had one, wow. And it was out in let's see, where was it? San Geronimo. It was basically north of San Francisco, which is an area I don't get to very often. So I really enjoyed the whole experience. It was a very, very nice area. Just that whole northern. Real Northern California vibe, you know, it definitely had set in, and rehearsing with those guys and talking with them was really cool. Really,
so,
really a good experience.
Did you have to bring your own instruments to the rehearsal, or did they have gear there for you?
No, I brought my own stuff.
And how many original guys are in the band?
Well, there's a couple different versions of Quicksilver, apparently, now. But Dino Valente, I want to make sure and pronounce that right, was the lead singer and wrote, from what I gather, most of the material for Quicksilver.
Is he gone now?
He passed away. I think he passed away. Oh, I think actually it's been a while. I think it's been a close to 10 years or so, maybe even more. And his son, Joe Lee, is singing for the group now.
Really?
Well, and he sounds just like his dad, just like him. I mean, it's amazing. Yeah, and Dino Valente wrote most of the songs.
What was their famous song? I don't know any of their material. Like, what was one of their big songs?
Well, probably their biggest hit, radio hit, was called Fresh Air. Have Another Hit, Fresh Air.
Oh, Have Another Hit.
Yep.
Fresh Air, that one?
That's Quicksilver.
Oh,
and
okay.
They had a couple other hits. One was called What About Me, and then there was Dino's song, Dino Valente wrote. And, there were a couple others, but this was very interesting. We ended our set with the song Get Together, you know, that the Youngbloods, Jesse Colin Young and the Youngbloods did, you know, Get Together. It's been used in so many commercials and movies and, just one of those songs that's very, very used, very popular. Anyway, we ended our set with that song, and I thought,
that's kind of strange. You're not talking about Fresh Air, are you?
No.
Are you talking about the one, come on, people now, get together?
Yeah.
One?
And we ended our set with that song, and I was kind of curious. I thought, why are we doing a Jesse Colin Young song? Well, I found out when I talked to Joe Lee, he said, my dad wrote that song. I said, you're kidding. He wrote Get Together. Yep.
Wow.
I didn't know that. I mean, that's a huge song. That song, when you hear that song, you think 60s. You think late 60s, hippie kind of peace, love. You know, that it's a staple, really. And
will you be playing with them again? I mean, was it enjoyable, the gig?
Yeah, it was very enjoyable, and I sure hope so. I hope that I get some more gigs with them. And, it just was a real, real cool experience.
Yeah, well, really, and speaking of cool experiences, I forgot to mention this. If anybody would like to call into the show, the number here is 888-429-5471. And I forgot to say, in case the CIA or the FBI or the NSA are listening, all those government pricks who like to give us a hard time, they can go screw themselves. I just forgot to say that. So while we still have free speech, that's what I think about them and the trouble they're stirring up throughout the world. But anyway, back to Quicksilver. So what was the Monterey Pop Festival like? How many bands? Was it a couple day event or was it one day event? Or
no, this one was a one day event, and it was supposedly the 45th anniversary to the Monterey. The famous Monterey Pop Festival that started it all in 1967, and I'm sure you know a little bit about that, PK, that was one of the most significant concerts in music history, is the Monterey Pop Festival, probably even more so than Woodstock, because it started it all. It started the whole Summer of Love and that whole generation, really.
But even before that, about a year before that or so, my biggest musical hero ever, my greatest musical hero, he's actually not that well known in the jazz community, turned their back on him, but he famously played, there's got a live album from the Monterey Jazz Festival, and that would be the Don Ellis Orchestra.
Uh-huh.
They also played the Fillmore later on, but yeah, that's how I knew about Monterey, and I've been to that fairground. It's a pretty neat place.
Yeah, it is. It is, and that's the famous stage that Jimi Hendrix burned his guitar on.
Right, often imitated, never duplicated. So, how many bands were there? There was Quicksilver.
Yeah, Big Brother and the Holding Company, Dave and Linda LaFlame from "It's a Beautiful Day." Sal Valentino from Bo Brummels. I had a nice conversation with him because I'm a fan. I said any group, anybody that can have their group get on an episode of the Flintstones is somebody I want to meet. The Bo Brummels were on an episode of the Flintstones.
And, as cartoon characters or providing music?
As cartoon characters, yeah. They use their hit song Laugh Laugh.
They were a British band, but didn't they take their name from some English dandy or something?
Yeah, they actually did. But no, they were a San Francisco band. That's one of the questions I asked Sal. I said, where were you guys from? Because I've heard so many things. I heard they were from San Jose. I heard they were from Walnut Creek. I even heard they were from Santa Cruz. But no, they were from San Francisco. He said, that's where we live, San Francisco. So they were a true San Francisco band. Because at that time, PK, as you probably know, if you were from anywhere around the Bay Area or Northern California, the record companies would say you were from San Francisco.
Oh, really?
So if you were from Hollister, they said you were from San Francisco. You know, they just that was what they did at that time. But Sal told me they were a true San Francisco band.
Unless you were from across the Bay in Tower of Power country in Oakland.
Well, no, Oakland was probably almost as significant. Yeah, to say you were from Oakland really cut some weight at that time as well.
Oakland didn't produce those kind of acid rock bands, although Sly and the Family Stone, Sly Sylvester Stone, who originally was a DJ, did incorporate a bit of that into his music.
Yeah, absolutely, and they were a milestone in the funk revolution and the whole funk movement. And yeah, they were the guys in Sly were, a lot of them were from Hayward, Castro Valley area, but some were spread out, I think, around possibly even Oakland. But you know, it was that whole East Bay thing, which I think you're a little familiar with, aren't you there, PK, about that?
Yes, but I think the most significant players from Sly and the Family Stone, the musicians, were, of course, the great Larry Graham, who originated slap funk, and, of course, the their drummer,
Greg Errico.
Say what?
Greg Errico.
Yeah, Greg Errico. He was a great drummer, and Garibaldi likes him from Tower of Power. He was a great – he laid it down real simple, you know, in the pocket, soul, funk,
absolutely.
Rock kind of groove.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely, yeah. Well, and they were probably one of – I can't say the first, but one of the first multiracial bands at that time. So that was a very interesting thing too, where
and
they –
the little footnote to that is that some idiots from the Black Panthers – told Sly to get rid of his white band members because he had a white saxophone player and a white drummer.
Yeah. Well, obviously he didn't do it, did he?
No, but it's just so stupid. You know, I think it's so idiotic.
Yeah. I agree. But yeah, you know, there was a lot of racial tension at that time, you know, a lot of pressure going on. I mean, a lot of, you know, the white guys, you know, Greg Errico and, Jerry Martini, who was a sax player, they were probably getting a lot of crap too by being in a black band. So it probably went both ways. You know, Sly probably got a lot of crap for having a couple of white guys. You know,
I wouldn't think the white guys got crap. I would think they got like, hey man, you're playing with Sly, you're lucky you. You know.
Well, that's the way I'd look at it. But you know, who knows at that time? It was probably a very difficult thing that they did, but. But, you know, thank God they did it because it brought more bands together, you know.
Well, yeah, and also the average white band's second drummer, the great Steve Ferrone, he's a black guy who's still going on, English. When he was playing in America, some black guys called his hotel room and told him, you know, what the hell are you doing playing in a white band for, you know. And he said, you know, he stood up to them, and they ended up coming to his room. He goes, and he's a black guy. He goes, open the door. I saw two of the biggest black guys I've ever seen. they wanted to kick my ass, but we talked, and they, you know, they went away. Everything was all right. But I just thought that was sort of a funny aside.
Yeah, yeah.
But most of my favorite bands are California bands, and I love, you know, that I lean, I guess, towards the Northern Cal. I mean, I loved Santana and Tower of Power. Doobie Brothers.
Yeah.
I used to think Steely Dan was a California band, but I don't think so. That's a New York band, although they may have recorded in L.A.
Yeah. Well, it's a tough thing, too, because you have to really consider when you say a band is a San Francisco band or a New York band or an L.A. band, well, does that mean that they're all from there, or does that mean that's where they got famous? You know, where Jimi Hendrix, I mean, was, you know, he was from, Indiana, I think? You know,
no,
he was
from Washington State. Go figure
was
that
from
one
Washington?
Out.
Okay, yeah, well, I wasn't sure on that, but I mean, Hendrix, people would probably say, oh, Hendrix was a San Francisco player, you know? Or, you know, but then he played a lot in Greenwich Village, too. He played a lot in New York, so it's really hard to say.
The problem he ran into was that black America basically turned their back on him or ignored him. So Hendrix went to England and made it big. Then he came back.
Yeah, right.
And even though he had the blues deeply mixed into his music and whatnot, you know, black Americans didn't, you know, he's mainly, he has mostly white fans, I would say.
Yeah, absolutely. He appealed to the middle upper class white teenager at that time. And when he was in England, he was managed by the Animals bass player Chas Chandler.
Really?
Yeah.
You're pretty smart for a musician.
Yeah. Well, I think he realized he saw Hendrix play. Hey, forget the Animals. I'm going to manage that guy.
You are pretty smart for a musician.
Oh, yeah, I'm pretty smart for a musician. Yeah, well.
You actually know a lot of this contemporary, you know, rock and roll history.
Yeah, well, you know, what I do. I mean, I don't do trigonometry, so got to do something.
Well, I read something. You mentioned math. About a month ago, I read about how math is overemphasized because most people don't need it unless, you know, the advanced stages of it, and unless you're going into engineering or, you know, rocket science or architecture. And here was the clincher of the article. As brilliant as doctors are and well-educated, the guy said, ask a doctor to help you do a math program. They're not very good at it. And yeah. I've spoken to a couple doctors since then, and it's true from what I could tell. You know, so I always sucked in math, but I see the importance of it, but not, you know, calculus and all that aren't, you know, helping me at all as a struggling musician.
Not helping you, I gotcha.
Were you good in math in school?
No, not really.
I heard that the only time you put your hand up in school was when you had to go to the bathroom. Is that true?
Basically, yeah.
Uh-huh.
That was pretty much it. Or you know, when it was time for lunch.
All right. Now, back to the Monterey Pop Festival. In those bands you mentioned, Quicksilver, Big Brother, and Bo Brummels. Are there any original members in any of those bands?
Yeah. Big Brother, I believe, was three original members on stage. Obviously, they had someone sitting in for Janis Joplin, and the girl did very well. I wish I could remember her name, but she did a real nice job. And I think that,
was she about Janis's age at the time?
About.
Uh-huh. So she had that raspy grit going on, huh?
Well, not like Janis, but then again, there will never be another Janis. But she delivered the songs real well, you know. I mean, maybe not as much grit, but I like the way she delivered the songs. She did a nice job.
What were some of the Bo Brummels hits?
Laugh, you know, laugh, and that really basically they had like two big hits: laugh, and Cry Just a Little. Actually, the song was titled Just a Little.
Huh.
But Laugh was a pretty good sized hit. But it's kind of interesting because the Bo Brummels weren't really psychedelic. They were kind of, their career was kind of over in the mid-60s. And the mid-60s was quite a bit different than the late 60s.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, the way people played guitar in 65 versus 68 was just light years difference. You know what I mean? It was like the recording quality, the recording technology from the mid-60s to the late 60s was very, very different. So the Bo Brummels fell more under that that mid-60s category, a little bit Beatlesque, a little bit folk.
I meant to ask you, I was thinking they were, you know, heavily influenced by the British bands of the day.
They were. The Bo Brummels definitely were.
Because they took their name. I mean, he was an English dandy, wasn't he, Bo Brummel?
Yeah. And I do believe that that's where they got the name. But I don't know. You know, if I ever talk to Sal Valentino again, I'll ask him that question.
Any relation to Rudolph Valentino?
No, I don't think so.
Well, I used to watch, when I got home from school, like in third grade, I used to watch Where the Action Is. And Paul Revere and the Raider were the house bands.
Yeah.
But I didn't realize then that most of those bands were just syncing.
Lip syncing?
Yeah.
Well, some of them were, but some of them were live, because I remember watching clips of that and hearing the mistakes. So some of them did play live.
I also used to watch, when I could, Hullabaloo and Shindig. Remember those?
Yeah, I don't remember those PK. Those were a little before my time, but I have seen the clips and seen the reruns. Yeah. And if you want to, anybody out there listening, if you want to go to YouTube and look up Laugh by the Bo Brummels or Just a Little, there's some pretty good cuts, and there's one, I think it is Shindig, that they're on, and it's live, and they do a nice job. It's a good song. And if anyone remembers that episode of the Flintstones where the Bo Brummels were on it, that would be fun.
I never knew that. I suppose it's available on the amazing YouTube.
I'm sure it is. Definitely. But hey, PK, we got to take a little short intermission here, right?
Oh, you want to go into your other, one of your other areas of expertise, and that is the concept of helping or facilitating the concept of foreign brides.
Yes.
Which we spoke about a few weeks ago when you were on. And I was wondering, in terms of the concept of foreign brides, what are some of the misconceptions? Again, I wanted to just review a couple things. Like, what are some of the misconceptions, and what are your competitors doing? Like, are they even matching up people very closely, like men with what they're looking for? Are they in the ballpark?
Well, you know, I'll say maybe they're in the ballpark. I'll give them credit, but there's a lot of mismatching going on in the dating world and the matchmaking world. Here in the States, this is where I differ with the philosophies of the United States and people that live here. They feel that if you're of the same age as another person, a man or a woman, then you are a match for them, which I completely disagree with. I mean, there's way, way, way too much emphasis placed on age. You know, I mean, I'm 48, and I consider myself in pretty good shape and still pretty good looking. And I'm ready to get up in the morning and go mountain climbing. I'm ready to go shopping. I'm ready to go fishing. I can go to the gym. I can go running. I can go swimming, surfing, whatever. Well, they'll match me up with a 48-year-old woman that can't get out of the chair, and the closest thing she comes to a vegetable is ketchup, you know?
Whoa.
And it's just not accurate, you know? I mean, they need to analyze and research a person a little bit more, you know?
Yeah.
So you know, the other difference I believe is if a person has had children, and you know, the person looking for a significant other maybe has kids, maybe they have grandkids at that point. And then someone like me that's never had children, well, I don't always consider myself a match for them, or them a match for me.
I recently went out with a cougar who's got some grandchildren, but she is a few years older than me, but very, very well preserved, very good shape. Had a little work done, but, you know, slender and and does yoga and works out and is very fit, puts some of the, you know, most women her age to shame.
Yeah, well, that's fantastic. Yeah, and if that works for a lot of men. But to answer your other question, you know, the other misconceptions about foreign brides is what I see a lot of men doing, the mistake they make is they'll go find a princess over there, whether it be the Ukraine, whether it be Russia, whether it be Latin America or Asia. They'll find a princess, you know, the most beautiful woman, girl that they can find, and then they get them back to America and try to make them do housework, you know? I mean,
well, what's wrong with that?
Well, it just doesn't, it isn't realistic, you know?
Haven't they done housework in the Ukraine?
Well, if you go and get a supermodel in the Ukraine, chances are she's going to be more materialistic, more self-absorbed than an American supermodel. And this is what I know from experience.
Well, either way, I wouldn't want one. I like them that they're elegant and low maintenance.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
They got to love me for who I am, not because I have this or that, or they want to keep up with the Joneses. I don't like that mentality. So, no, I wouldn't want a princess from any country, you know?
Right, and that's one of the biggest mistakes men make is they, oh, my God, look at this one. She's gorgeous. She looks like a model. She's perfect. She's, you know, got perfect teeth, perfect hair. And you know, it's like, well, how do you think she got that way? You know, it was basically a lot of focus on herself.
Well,
and you know, I'm not saying all beautiful women have that kind of attitude, but I see men making that mistake as opposed to trying to find a significant other. Maybe a little more humble and modest and, you know, maybe not so glamorous, but, you know, that would be a good woman and a good companion.
Well, humility is definitely one of my stronger traits. And in fact, a big part of the problem is that ever since they were young girls, women have been told or taught that men are perfect, and we're not.
Yeah.
You know? I say to girls, you know, you've been taught since you were little girls that men are perfect, but we're not. So, you know, we have that hurdle to pass, too.
Yeah, we're not, yeah. You know? Well, No one's perfect. But, yeah, that's one thing that I see going on. And in the industry, there's a lot of scamming. Sex chats are huge. I mean, and these I want to say ignorant men are throwing thousands and thousands upon thousands of dollars away on these sex chats with these girls that don't even know them, for one. Two, don't care a thing about them. And, you know, these men are getting nowhere. I mean, I guess if it makes them feel better, then that's their business. But it really is sad because half the time they're not even talking to who they think they're talking to.
Well, I hope you advise them about the pitfalls of the, you know, the supreme hotties and what they want or don't want.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I try my best. But, yeah, that's one of the misconceptions is they think that they're going to get a girl, you know, from state of Ukraine. Oh, I'm getting a girl from a poor country. So even though she's, you know, runway model, beautiful, you know, drop dead gorgeous, she's going to be a humble housewife and, you know, be on her hands and knees scrubbing floors. And that generally isn't the way it works.
Well, I like the concept of them being on their hands and knees, but not necessarily, you know, doing floors.
Yeah, exactly. Well, there's apparently not enough of that going on either, because the Ukrainian and Russian girls, or all fake girls from Eastern Europe in general, are very, very sharp. They don't have to put out. You know, most of them don't, matter of fact. That's from my research. And my research extends way past my own experiences. And, you know, I mean, these girls, they'll even marry men and not have sex with them.
Wow. Usually the case? Isn't that how you stop a woman from screwing, marry her?
Yeah, that's what they say. They say it works every time.
Or my favorite is, what kind of food causes women to lose their sex drive?
Everything.
Wedding cake.
Yeah, that's a good one. Well, actual friend of mine told me that this was a real life experience, and he said, I've been married four times, and he said, I'll tell you something. He said, I'll give you some advice. Do you know how to make a flaming nymphomaniac woman a frigid woman? And I said, no, how do you do that? I said, marry her. It works every time.
Yeah.
This was a guy that was married four times.
Well, the thing is, you got to find a woman who can really cook well. You got to find a woman who can really, you know, clean well and take care of things. Uh-huh. And you got to find a woman who's a really good lover.
Mm-hmm.
And you got to make sure that those women never meet each other.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Exactly. There you go, PK. I like that one. But anyways, yeah. So do you have any more questions to ask me about the foreign bride before we wrap it up?
Well, I got a friend who he's been to the Dominican Republic a couple times, and
yeah.
He wasn't really looking for a bride, but there's a lot of sex tourism there. But he said it's beautiful. The women are beautiful and friendly, and he recommend going there. Have you been there?
I have been there, and it's a really good place. Just even if you're not looking for a woman per se, just for a vacation, it's much cheaper than Hawaii.
Sure.
Granted, you're not in the United States, but climate is very, very similar. It's nice and warm and beautiful beaches and nice warm water and just a great place for a vacation. You're treated quite well, too. The people of the Dominican Republic are very eager to serve you and to accommodate you. But there's a lot of beautiful women in the Dominican Republic. Have to be beautiful. Because there's a lot of prostitution there. You know, a lot of young women will get pregnant and be on their own with a child, and so they'll, you know, the Americans and the Europeans that come over for vacation, a lot of these women will, you know, will prey on them, basically, for money. And so you have to be careful there. But, no, Dominican Republic is a great place, and I would highly recommend that to someone that's looking for a foreign bride.
How is the food down there?
The DR? Well, the food, where I was, the food was excellent, but that was a resort. So as far as you know, the native food, I can't really say.
Because I like the native ethnic food, like, you know, the chicken or the ribs or the stuff that because I like Caribbean food. I like the Caribbean. In fact, I prefer it to Hawaii. It's closer, it's less expensive, and it's more diverse. Hawaii's beautiful. I recommend anybody who can visit should go.
Yeah. The ethnic food in the DR I can't tell you about, unfortunately. But the food was good where I was, at the resort. In the Ukraine and Russia, I can tell you about the ethnic food there because I tried it and I liked it. I thought it was very good.
So did in the Dominican Republic, for example, at the resort, did most of the staff speak English or enough English?
Oh, yeah. Most spoke English, yeah. It seemed like everywhere I went in the DR, everyone spoke English.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Did you venture very far from your resort, or were you in Santo Domingo?
No, I did. I did a little bit. I ventured out a little bit, not too far, but kind of explored a little bit. And I don't want to discourage anyone from trying to pick up a little Spanish. Now, that's a very good idea if you go to the DR.
Yeah.
But you can get around without it if you have to.
And did you fly into Santo Domingo?
No, I flew into Punta Cana.
And then, is that where the resort was?
Yes.
You flew directly there?
Yeah.
Wow. I thought you had to go to Santo Domingo first.
No.
Really?
Nope.
Wow. And how did you get to your destination? Did they have a shuttle or?
Yeah, they had a shuttle. Like I said, everyone's very accommodating. The service was very, very, very good.
Well, that's pretty cool.
Yeah. Well, listen, PK, I gotta wrap it up here.
I know you've got to go, Blaine. Thanks for sharing some of that info about the music and the Monterey Pop. I'm glad you got to play that. I wish I could have been there. I bet it was pretty cool and legendary stage and the traditions of the place.
Absolutely. Yeah. It was great.
And thanks for another brief insight on the Ukraine and the foreign women thing. I hope men don't get ripped off by it, and they shouldn't think that they're going to get, don't get the best-looking chick and think you're going to bring this princess home and be able to afford her and, spoil her. And it's just, it gets old, I think, keeping up with the Joneses.
That's right.
All right, sir. Well, thank you for coming on, Blaine, and we'll talk to you soon.
Okay. Thank you, PK.
Have a good one.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. So now the mighty PK... I am back now. My guest has gone, and I'm going to get back into this current events thing. Today we celebrated Columbus Day, and of course there's a lot of politically correct the crowd and bitching about, Columbus did this and that to the Indians and, da-da-da-da-da. And I'm not denying that, because as I've said before, and this is sort of, pre-colonialism with Columbus's discovery, is that I deplore all the brutality from colonizing, those days and all that stuff. In slavery, I deplore all the brutality, but I applaud the technology and education, school, medicine, spreading the good aspects of democracy. Which would be like a free press and, free elections and, free speech. But I'm very, as I've mentioned before, my views on democracy are very, very narrow. Mainly, democracy is the peaceful way in which we select our leaders, and also the democracy of the marketplace, where every penny is essentially a vote for what you want. And unlike government, you don't get what you want when you vote. You think you do, and they got us to believe in that, some of us, I don't, for many years now, that there's actually a difference between the parties, when actually the parties are very similar, like that, whom I think is despicable, Carol Quigley wrote in the 60s in his book Tragedy and Hope, how the elitists the globalist, the New World Order, if you will, which he condoned, by the way. He was in academia, but he condoned that. He was Clinton's mentor. He said that you know, the elitists try to portray like there's a difference between the two parties when essentially there isn't. But the facade is carried forward, even to today. Because the choice between Obama and Romney is more like the choice between Coke or Pepsi. They're basically the same on the surface. Oh, they differ on certain things. Oh, no, gay marriage or this and that let's see, what else? Abortion, perhaps. Although it would seem like when Romney sticks his finger up in the air, wets his finger and sticks it up in the air, to see which way the wind blowing is which way his philosophy or his so-called principles are for the time being. But when you look at Obama and Romney, they're both pro-war, pro-empire, pro-Federal Reserve, pro-widening the wars, pro-Israel, pro-Zionism. It's a facade that Obama's hard on Israel. They're still getting subsidized and plenty of free goodies from Uncle Sam and American taxpayers. Obama and Romney are pro-Gitmo. They're pro-Federal Reserve. They're pro-Patriot Act. They're pro-Military Detention Act. I mean, can you believe that Obama signed that? You know, it's just awful. So anyway, back to today being Columbus Day. You know, there's the usual criticism of Columbus. He was so bad, da-da-da-da-da. And, you know, we learned he discovered America. Well, he may have been one of the first to discover it and make it known, but as I understand it, the Vikings or the Scandinavians were here before Columbus was. Probably maybe hundreds of years before, because they were good navigators too and very sturdy and very hardy people. I've been to Norway and Sweden and Finland, and a beautiful country. Nice people, clean cities. I wouldn't care to live there. Well, it's wonderful in the summertime. I wouldn't care to spend a winter there. But they are a seafaring race and probably smaller boats and really hardy. They probably even clashed with the Indians when they came over. I think they landed in Greenland and maybe, you know, Canada or Maine. So interesting migration from Europe. But so, yes, you know, Columbus gets all this grief. I remember years ago, maybe it was about 20 years ago, I went to see the movie. In fact, there was one or two movies about Columbus. One had Gerard Jadot playing. Am I pronouncing that right? Right? Gerard. I can't think of his last name. Gadu, something like that. And then there was one with Tom Selleck. So I deliberately went to see the movies because there was, you know, so much protesting or criticism of them. And, you know, but it showed some of the brutality in Columbus leaving people in charge who didn't take care of things or who killed Indians. Of course, I think when Columbus came back, the bunch he left or the little fort they built or whatever, they were killed. But there you have it. So I'm not making a big deal out of all this politically correct nonsense or judging, you know, trying to persecute people for the sins of their ancestors. You know. So there's that usual stuff going on. And now Ahmadinejad was here, and now the video I've seen of him a couple years ago, he meets with this bunch of American rabbis, and I'm very big fan of their spokesman, the rabbi spokesman, Rabbi David Weiss, who is one of the leaders, if not one of the founders of, and I've mentioned this before on my show, very important group. They're called Jews United Against Zionism. I've checked out their website. I've read their mission statements, their philosophies, and I'm here to tell you that those folks, although small in number, they are on the right track in terms of philosophy, in terms of their viewpoint and their outlooks towards Palestine and the Palestinians. And they will tell you that, according to the Torah, the Old Testament, that the Jews are not supposed to have their own country. They're supposed to live peacefully and cooperate in their host countries. And if and when the Messiah comes back is when they'll get their own country. Now, this is not what American Christian Zionists believe. They think you got to support Israel at all costs. But, you know, that's the problem. But anyway, Ahmadinejad is meeting with all these rabbis, and they give him a gift at the end and are speaking with him, and he's hugging them and, you know, doing the cordial greetings. And it's very interesting to watch. And, of course, this is greatly disliked by the masses. I mean, it's discouraged. Its showing is discouraged. I think it's about, I don't know, it's about 8 minutes long, I think. It's very interesting, and it's very friendly and peaceful and loving. So it's definitely worth seeing. You could probably just Google Ahmadinejad and the rabbis. And, you know, Iran has at least 25,000 unthreatened Persian Jews living there. And, of course, Persia being the former name for Iran. I know this gets a little complicated, but bear with me, folks, and don't sweat it because, as I like to say, I'm an American who actually knows world geography and world history. Of course not all of it. No one knows all of it, especially historians. They don't know all of it. No one will know all of it, but some might know a lot of it. And on this show, I really value and I treasure objective intellectual revisionist history, because otherwise too many people are content to let sleeping dogs lie. Emphasis on lie in this part, because if you just let sleeping dogs lie, then you accept myths and you accept history written by the victors. So that is something to keep in mind. History is usually always written by the winners, by the victors, especially World War II, World War I. Pat Buchanan has a good article called "Is a Nuclear Deal with Iran Possible?" And, you know, according to Pat, the U.S. and Israel neither have discovered any site devoted to building nuclear weapons. And they're only enriching uranium to about 20%. None of it, no reports up to 90%. And, you know, Ahmadinejad himself, he mocks the idea of Iran building a nuke, you know, in the face of the U.S. commitment to go to war to prevent it. So, you know, I think he said, let's even imagine that we have an atomic weapon, a nuclear weapon. What would we do with it? What intelligent person would fight 5,000 American bombs with one bomb? You know, plus, as Ron Paul has pointed out, was it Ron Paul? Let me get my thoughts straight on this. Let me move to something else here about Ahmadinejad. You know, he didn't even mention that Israel has 200 to 300 nukes. So that is, you know, what they'd be vaporized. They understand that. But if you have a nuke, then you don't get messed with by Uncle Sam and probably Israel. You know, that is an important thing to keep in mind. And I saw him being interviewed by, was it Piers Morgan yesterday, and Piers was trying to be real pushy and everything. And Ahmadinejad did not say that Iran wants to wipe Israel off the map. That's ridiculous. He says something more to the effect of, just like the former Soviet regime vanished from the pages of history, so must the Zionist regime vanish from the pages of history. Not Jews, but the Zionist regime. In fact, Ron Paul pointed out, I knew there were some, I didn't realize this, but there's about there's something like about 50 American bases ringed around Iran, probably some in Pakistan, Afghanistan, other Middle Eastern countries, Iraq. So, you know, it's got a ring of American bases around it. So, you know, the real belligerent is Uncle Sam. You know, the real axis of evil is the U.S., Britain, and France. Sorry, Britain and Israel. And each of them has their own CIA. The U.S. has the CIA, Britain has MI6 and James Bond, and Israel has Mossad. And as I've said on this show before, I believe that Mossad is very, very involved, that its fingerprints are all over 9/11. I believe that very much. So back to Iran. I think that the embargo is an awful thing, the sanctions. It's just hurting the regular people. There's not back to Iran. Well, back to like Pat Buchanan would say, this thing about Iran is, or I'm saying, if they're stupid enough to attack Iran, that's like 70 million people. Now, this America's already bankrupt. Our precious taxes and capital is going to rebuild Iraq and Afghanistan, nation building. Meanwhile, our country is crumbling. There's not enough money for our schools and whatnot, and to shore up the admittedly unsound Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. And as Ron Paul says, if the currency collapses and the country goes even further bankrupt, there won't be any money to pay people of the so-called entitlements, especially the needy. You know, that won't happen. And so if they start another war, if not World War III, with Iran, that's a country of like 70 million people. What, it would be rebuilding that country too? While America continues to crumble and China steps up more? So, you know, I see it as quite a mess and just making it worse. And like I like to say, and I hope you're listening, Israel and Mossad and all you other bastards out there who are the pro-Israeli lobby and their puppets in the CIA and the FBI and NSA. You know, who are listening, America had no enemies in the Middle East before 1948 when Israel was violently opposed upon Palestine. Now, folks, you won't hear this on regular, you know, network TV or radio. Thank goodness for alternative media, as I said at the beginning of my show, because I can speak my mind and fill you in on things that you're not going to hear from the staged corporate Zionist media. Lapdogs of the regime in power, regardless of what party is in power, and heavily infiltrated by the CIA. I didn't realize how much they manipulate other events and other governments. Even now, CIA, Mossad, Britain's MI6, and probably French intelligence, they're disrupting things in Syria. They're causing more problems. And Israel is very good at impersonating Arabs, false flag attacks and such and whatnot. In terms of Israel's attack on the World Trade Center, you should check out Dr. Alan Sabotsky. He's a former Marine, and he's in Vietnam. He's got a Jewish background, and he contends from his research that this is a classic Mossad operation. I even believe that there's folks in the U.S. military who know this, and they they acknowledge it, but they're not talking about it much. They probably get pressure from elsewhere about it. But that's something to keep in mind. I was trying to find his name, or the correct spelling. Alan Sabotsky. I think it's S-K-Y. But he has a very interesting, you know, outlook on the situation with 9/11. And I see it as, I see that Mossad pulled it off, and then they've got, you know, more sympathy for Israel, and then Israel gets even more, even a more vast supply of free American-made murder weapons, an endless supply of those. And they want the U.S. to attack Iran. I think that the U.S. should attack Netanyahu, waterboard him, because if there's a war, he won't be going. It's the young folks that are going to be going and dying. Meanwhile, the U.S. military families are struggling like crazy. Military suicides are at an all-time high, as are military spousal abuse and divorce. So you mean to tell me if there's more war and heavy U.S. involvement that there's not going to be more massive problems? I mean, look at oil. Iran's oil exports, according to Pat Buchanan, are down 800,000 barrels a day. That's a third of what they were a year ago. You know, so these sanctions really hurt the regular people in Iran, and it's so unnecessary. And it's like, as Ron Paul says, it is an act of war. So I can just imagine the U.S. messing this up, the federal government, and then sticking the bill to the American taxpayer. And probably the unemployment rate is more like over 20%. Maybe it's about 22, 23% in the U.S. Sending more money overseas to prop up or subsidize our rich allies for defense and foreign aid to Israel. And, you know, I'd cut off all foreign aid to all foreign countries. It's unconstitutional. It props up regimes. It props up inefficient industries. It hurts the local industries. So the U.S. federal government not only messes up 99% of what it does at home, but it does abroad too. It's very interventionist, and it's, you know, arrogant, and just causes so much war and intervention and grief. So it's something to keep in mind. I think I'm running out of time here. Checking with the suits. So we'll see what happens, how this Iran thing plays out. I know that Romney is very, very pro-war, and he's willing to, you know, he's very buddy-buddy with Israel. So he's ready to create more war with Iran. And even though Obama already signed the largest military budget ever, Romney wants to spend more on the military. Well, PK says that's stealing very precious investment capital that for more important private sector needs. So then you have, I hope that Obama doesn't decide to attack Iran safely after the election. I mean, who knows what this guy's up to? And, you know, he serves the Israeli lobby, as does Romney. So those Republicans who want to cut back, yeah, example, and fool Rubio, he opposed cutting foreign aid. You know, Rand Paul was one of the good things. He was for cutting off foreign aid. Rubio was against it. Certain prominent, you know, politicians, they want the American taxpayer to keep wasting our money on countries that don't like us. It's unconstitutional anyway, because foreign aid props up foreign dictatorships, props up inefficient domestic industries from competition. It hurts, for example, local farmers if it's foreign aid in terms of food and local manufacturing. How are they going to compete with things that are given to them free? So if it was voluntary charity, and people could just write a check and send it to the people they want to help, that would be a much more efficient, better way of allocating help. So anyway, we jumped to a lot of things tonight on the show, and I had my friend Blaine on, but that's what I can do on this show. I have the ability to multitask, if you will, go from topic to topic, usually within a realm of politics, music, my cut-to-the-chase solutions for situations. So anyway, with that, I am going to sign off. I'm your humble host, PK, and I'm here every Monday evening, 9 o'clock Pacific, 10:55 Central, 11:55 Eastern, here on bbsradio.com, station 2. And with that, ladies and gentlemen, the mighty, most enlightened PK bid you all farewell to next week. Same time, same place. Good night, everyone.